It will be a formidable task, requiring a good deal of my time. Perhaps even a permanent assignment to Caladan. Yes, and Duke Atreides will pay for everything. Behind his thin spectacles, Calamar's eyes continued to shine. We cannot pass up an opportunity like this. The main hall of Castle Caladan seemed too large, as did the ancient ducal chair, from which Paulus Atreides had spent so many years ministering to his people. Leto seemed unable to fill the vast spaces around him, or in his heart. But still, he had ventured out of his room. That much, at least, was progress. Duncan Idaho has brought a most disturbing matter to my attention, Tesha. Leto stared at the slender woman who stood before him, her mousy brown hair cut boyishly short. Did you make arrangements for a Sook doctor to come here? A cyborg specialist? Wearing a Velglow robe, Tesha shifted on her feet and nodded. She did not take her sepia eyes from him, showing a strength like steel that skirted the edges of defiance.
You told me to find any way to help him if I could. I have done so. This is Romber's only chance.
Her face flushed.
Would you deny it to him?
Dressed in a black and red Atreides uniform, the new swordmaster, Duncan Idaho, stood at one side, scowling. Did you speak on the Duke's behalf and make promises without discussing them? You're just a concubine.
My Duke gave me permission to take any necessary steps.
Tesha turned to Leto.
Would you rather we left Romber as he is now? Or would you prefer we ask the Tleilaxu to grow replacement body parts for him? My prince would choose to die, if that were the only other option. Dr. Yue's new cyborg work offers us another chance.
While Duncan continued to scowl, Leto found himself nodding. He shuddered at the thought of how much of his friend's body would be replaced with synthetic parts. When is this Sook doctor scheduled to arrive?
In a month. Romber can stay on life support that long, and Dr. Yue requires the time to build components to match Romber's losses.
Leto took a deep breath. As his father had instructed him so many times, a leader must always remain in control, or give the impression that he is. Tesha had acted ambitiously, spoken in his name, and Duncan Idaho was right to be upset. But there had never been any question as to whether Leto would spend every solari in the house Atreides coffers to help Romber. Tesha straightened, and the fierce love in her eyes was genuine. Duncan cautioned, though.
There are political complexities you must remember, sire. Vernius and Richese have been rivals for generations. There may be a plot afoot.
My mother was born a Richese, Leto pointed out. And therefore so am I, by distaff lineage. Count Ilban, a mere figurehead on Richese, wouldn't dare strike against my house.
Duncan's forehead wrinkled in thought. Cyborgs are composite living forms with machine-body interfaces.
Tesha remained stony.
So long as none of the parts simulate the workings of the human mind, we have nothing to fear.
There is always something to fear, Duncan said, thinking of the unexpected ambush and slaughter on Ginaz. Gruff and stern, he sounded like Thufir Hawat now, who had not yet returned from his negotiations with the Tleilaxu. Fanatics do not examine evidence rationally. Leto was not entirely recovered from his injuries. He heaved a tired sigh and raised a hand to silence the young man before he could make another argument.
Enough, Duncan. Tesha. Of course we'll pay. If there's a chance to save Romber, we must do it.
On an overcast afternoon, Leto sat in his study trying to concentrate on the business of Caladan. For years, even when their relationship had soured, Kylea had done more work than Leto had ever realized. He sighed and went over the numbers again. Thufir Hawat strode in, fresh from the spaceport. Deeply troubled, the Mentat thumped a sealed message cylinder on the desk and stepped back, as if in disgust.
From the Tleilaxu, sire. These are their terms. Duke Leto lifted the cylinder, looking pensively at Hawat, searching for any hint, any reaction. Suddenly apprehensive, he pried off the cap. A sheet of tan paper fell out, as supple as if it had been made from human skin. He scanned the words quickly. His pulse quickened. To the Atreides. After your unprovoked attack on our transport ships and your devious escape from true justice, the Bene Tleilax have awaited an opportunity such as this. The palms of his hands were moist and clammy as he continued. Leto knew Hawat disagreed with his idea to offer the Tleilaxu information about the invisible Harkonnen attack ship. If too many people learned about the dangerous technology, it could fall into the wrong hands. For the time being, the wreckage seemed safe enough with the Bene Gesserit, who had no military aspirations of their own. One thing was certain, though. The Tleilaxu would never believe him without proof. We can return your son to you, but you must pay a price. Not in Solaris, spice, or other valuables. Instead, we demand that you surrender Prince Romber Vernius to us, the last of the Vernius bloodline, and the only person who continues to threaten our possession of Shuta. No, Leto whispered. Hawat stared at him like a grim statue. He continued to read. We give our guarantees and assurances that Romber will not be physically harmed. But you must make a choice. Only this way can you have your son back. Hawat seethed with anger as Leto finished reading. We should have expected this. I should have predicted it. Leto spread the parchment out in front of him and spoke in a small voice. Leave me to consider this, Thufir. Consider it? Hawat looked at him in surprise. My Duke, you cannot possibly entertain. Seeing Leto's glare, the Mentat fell silent. With a brief bow, he departed from the study. Leto stared at the terrible terms until his eyes burned. For generations, House Atreides had stood for honor, for the course of righteousness and integrity. He felt a deep obligation to the exiled prince. But for Victor... Victor... Wouldn't Romber be better off dead anyway? Better off without inhuman cyborg replacements? As Leto considered this, he felt a dark stillness in his soul. Would history judge him severely for selling Romber to his sworn enemies? Would he become known as Leto the Betrayer instead of Leto the Just? It was an impossible conundrum. The intense loneliness of leadership enveloped him. In his soul of souls, at the deepest core where only he could look and find absolute truth, Duke Leto Atreides wavered. Which is more important, my closest friend or my son? The ego is only a bit of consciousness swimming upon the ocean of dark things. We are an enigma unto ourselves. The Mentat Handbook. In her own apartment, Jessica lay beside Duke Leto on the wide bed, trying to soothe his nightmares. A number of scars on his chest and legs required additional new skin wraps to repair them completely. Much of Leto's body had healed, though the tragedy festered in him, along with the terrible decision he had to make. His friend or his son? Jessica was sure that seeing a gola of Victor each day would only worsen his pain. But she had been unable to say this to him. She searched for the right words, the right moment. Duncan is upset with me, Leto said, pushing away from her to gaze into her clear green eyes. So is Thufir, and probably Gurney too. Everyone challenges my decisions. They are your advisers, my lord, she said, treading cautiously. They are required to counsel you. In this matter, I've had to tell them to keep their opinions to themselves. This is my decision to make, Jessica. But what am I to do? The Duke's face darkened with anger, and his eyes misted over. I have no other options, and only the Tleilaxu can do it. I miss my son too much." His eyes begged for her understanding, her support. "How can I choose? How can I say no? The Tleilaxu will bring Victor back."
"At the cost of Romber. And perhaps the price of your soul," she said. "To sacrifice your friend for a false hope? I fear that will be your downfall. Please don't do this, Leto."
Romber should have died in the crash.
"Perhaps. But that was in God's hands, not yours. He still lives. Despite everything, he still has the will to live."
Leto shook his head. "Romber will never recover from his injuries. Never. Dr. Yue's cyborg work will give him a chance." He glowered at her, suddenly defensive.
"What if the robotic enhancements don't work? What if Romber doesn't want them? Maybe he's better off dead."
"If you give him to the Tleilaxu, they will never allow him a simple death." She paused, and in a gentle tone suggested,
"Perhaps you should go see him again. Look down at your friend and listen to what your heart tells you. Look at Tesha. Look into her eyes. Then talk to Thufir and Duncan.
I don't need to explain myself to them or to anyone else. I am Duke Leto Atreides."
"Yes, you are. And you are a man, too."
Jessica fought to control her emotions. She stroked his dark hair.
"Leto, I know you're only acting out of love, but sometimes love can guide a person in the wrong direction. Love can blind us to the truth. You're on the wrong path, my Duke, and you know it in your heart."
Although he turned away from her, she did not relent.
"You must never love the dead more than the living."
Thufir Hawat, concerned as always, accompanied the Duke to the infirmary, where Romber's life support pod bristled with fittings for intravenous tubes, catheters, and scanners. The whir and hum of machinery filled the room, stirring the smell of chemicals. Hawat lowered his voice.
"This can only lead to your ruin, my Duke. Accepting the Tleilaxu offer would be a betrayal, a dishonorable course of action."
Leto folded his arms across his chest. "You have served House Atreides for 3 generations, Thufir Hawat, and you dare to question my honor?" The Mentat pressed ahead. "The medical attendants are attempting to establish a means of communicating with Romber's brain while he remains in the life support pod. Soon he will be able to speak again, and tell you in his own words. The decision is mine to make, Thufir." Leto's eyes seemed darker than usual, like thunderheads. "Will you do as I ask, or must I obtain a more obedient Mentat?"
"As you command, my Duke." Hawat bowed. "However, it would be better to let Romber die now, rather than permit him to fall into the hands of the Tleilaxu."
By prior arrangement, UA's cyborg team was scheduled to arrive soon to begin the complex process of rebuilding Romber part by part, establishing proper machine-body interfaces. In an amalgamation of engineering and medical technology, the Sook doctor would weave machine into tissue, and tissue into machine. New and old, hard and soft, lost abilities restored. If Leto permitted it to proceed, Dr. Yue and his team would be playing God. Playing God. The Bene Tleilax did that too. Using other techniques, they could bring back what had been lost, what had died. They required only a few cells, carefully preserved. Taking a deep breath, Leto stepped to the life support pod, where he looked down at the bandaged horror, the burned remnants of his longtime friend. He reached for the curved glass that showed the unrecognizable man inside. His fingers touched the slick surface, trembling with a strange mixture of fear and fascination. Tears streamed down his cheeks. A cyborg. Would Romber hate Leto for that, or thank him? At least he would still be alive.
in a manner of speaking.
Romber's body was so twisted and mangled that it no longer seemed human. Fittings had been customized for the mass of flesh and bone. Narrow fragments of raw tissue lay exposed around the edges of tubings and covers. One side of the face and brain had been crushed, and only a single bloodshot eye remained, unfocused. The eyebrow was blonde, the only suggestion that this was truly Prince Vernius. Never love the dead more than the living. Leto placed a hand on the clearplas barrier. He saw Romber's finger stubs and a heat fusion of metal and flesh where his fire jewel ring had once been.
"I won't let you down, friend," Leto promised in a whisper. "You can count on me to do the right thing."
In the barracks of the Atreides House Guard, two men sat at a rough wooden table, passing a bottle of Pundi rice wine between them. Though initially strangers, Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho already conversed like lifelong friends. They had a great deal in common, especially an intense hatred of the Harkonnens, and an unbridled love for Duke Leto.
"I'm deeply concerned about him. This Gola matter..." Duncan shook his head. "I do not trust Golas."
"Nor do I, lad. That creature would be a pale reminder of the saddest time Leto has ever experienced, without memories of its former life." Gurney tilted his cup for a long, thoughtful swig of wine, then lifted his balisette from beside the table and began to strum.
"And the cost? To sacrifice Romber?
But Leto would not listen to me."
"Leto is not the same person I knew before."
Gurney stopped strumming.
"And who would be, after all that pain?"
The Tleilaxu master Zaf arrived on Caladan, accompanied by two bodyguards and hidden weapons. Haughty and self-confident, he strode up to Thufir Hawat in the main hall of Castle Caladan and looked up at the much taller Mentat.
"I have come for the body of the boy so that we can prepare it for our axolotl tank."
Zaf narrowed his eyes, utterly confident that Leto would bow to their demands.
"I have also made arrangements to transport the life support pod of Romber Vernius back to the medical and experimental facilities on Tleilax."
Noting the sly upward curl of the mouth, Hawat knew that these fiends would commit atrocities upon Romber's ragged body. They would experiment, grow clones from the living cells, then perhaps torture the clones as well. Eventually, this terrible decision would come back to haunt Leto. Death for his friend would be preferable to that. The Tleilaxu representative twisted the knife deeper.
"My people can do much with the genetics of both the Atreides and Vernius families. We are looking forward to many options."
"I have advised the Duke against this course of action." Hawat knew he must face Leto's wrath, but old Paulus had often said, "Any man, even the Duke himself, must choose the welfare of House Atreides over his own." Hawat would offer his resignation from service, if necessary. At that moment, Leto walked into the room, looking more self-confident than the Mentat had seen him for many weeks. Gurney Halleck and Jessica followed him. With an inexplicable strength showing on his face, the Duke looked at Hawat, then bowed slightly in formal diplomatic greeting to the Tleilaxu ambassador.
"Duke Atreides," Zaf said, "it is possible this business arrangement can bridge the gulf between your house and my people."
Leto looked down his hawkish nose at the little man. "Unfortunately, that bridge will never be built." Hawat readied himself as the Duke stepped forward, close to Zaf. Gurney Halleck also looked ready for murder. He exchanged uneasy glances with Hawat and Jessica. When the Tleilaxu bodyguards tensed, the warrior Mentat made ready for a quick, bloody battle in the large echoing chamber. With a scowl, the Tleilaxu representative said,
"Are you reneging on our agreement?"
"I made no agreement to break. I have decided that your price is too high. For Romber, for Victor, and for my own soul. Your trip here has been in vain.
The Duke's voice remained strong and firm. There will be no Gorla made of my firstborn son, and you will not have my friend, Prince Vernius. Stunned, Thufir, Gurney, and Jessica looked on. Leto's face had an impenetrable hardness and a new resolve. I understand your continued petty desire for revenge against me, even though the trial by forfeiture exonerated me of all charges. I have sworn that I did not attack your ships inside the Highliner, and the word of an Atreides is worth more than all the laws in the Imperium. Your refusal to believe me shows your own foolishness. The Tleilaxu man appeared outraged, but Leto continued with a sharp, cold voice that stopped Zaf before he could utter a sound. I have learned the explanation behind the attack. I know who did it and how. But since I have no tangible proof, informing you would accomplish nothing. The Bene Tleilax have no interest in the truth anyway, only in the price you can extract from me. And I will not pay it. At a whistle from Hawat, the ever-alert Atreides house guard rushed in and took control of the Tleilaxu bodyguards, while Gurney and Hawat stepped forward on either side of a spluttering Master Zaf. I'm afraid we do not require the services of the Tleilaxu. Not today, not ever, Leto said, and then turned, dismissing him rudely. Go home. Hawat took great pleasure in escorting the indignant man out of the castle. The individual is shocked by the overwhelming discovery of his own mortality. The species, however, is different. It need not die. Pardet Kynes, an Arrakis primer. Of all the ecological demonstration projects Pardet Kynes had established, the sheltered greenhouse cave at Plaster Basin was his favorite. With his lieutenant, Amun, and 15 hard-working Freeman followers, Kynes summoned an expedition to visit the site. Though it wasn't on his regular schedule of plantings or inspections, Pardet simply wanted to see the cave with the running water, hummingbirds, moisture dripping from ceiling rock, fresh fruit, and bright flowers. It all represented his vision of Dune's future. The group of freemen took a worm east across the 60-degree line that surrounded the northern inhabited areas. In his long years here, Kynes had never learned to become a sand rider, so Amun rigged up a palanquin for him. The planetologist rode like an old woman, but without embarrassment. He had nothing to prove. Once, long ago, when Leet had been only a year old, Pardet had taken his wife Freeth and their child to Plaster Basin. A woman who rarely displayed amazement or outright wonder, Freeth had been dumbstruck when she first saw the greenhouse cave, the thick foliage, the flowers and birds. Just before that, though, on the way up the rugged mountainside to the hidden cavern, they had been attacked by a Harkonnen patrol. Freeth, thinking fast and using her freeman training, had saved the lives of her husband and son. Kynes paused in his plodding procession of thoughts and scratched his beard, wondering if he had ever thanked her for that. Since the day of his son's wedding to Ferula, when Leet had chastised him for his distraction and unintentional coldness, Kynes had done a great deal of thinking, assessing what he had accomplished in his life. His years on Seleucus Secundus and Bella Tejus, his astonishing summons to Elrud's court at Kytane, his 2 decades here as Imperial Planetologist. He had spent his career delving into explanations, seeing the convoluted tapestry of the environment. He understood the ingredients, from the power of water and sun and weather, to organisms in the soil, plankton, lichens, insects, how it was all connected to human society. Kynes understood how the pieces fit, at least in general terms, and he was among the best planetologists in the Imperium. He'd been called a world reader, selected for this most important assignment by the Emperor himself. And yet how could he consider himself a detached observer? How could he stand apart from the complex web of interactions that ran each planet, each society?
He was himself a piece of the grand scheme, not an impartial experimenter. There could be no outside to the universe. Scientists had known for thousands of years that an observer affects the outcome of an experiment, and Parditkind himself had certainly affected the changes on Dune. How could he have forgotten that? After Amon helped him to dismount from the worm within walking distance of Plaster Basin, they led him to the blackened greenish ridge that enclosed the cave. Kynes imitated their random walk motions until his legs ached. He would never truly be a Freeman, unlike his son. Leet had all the knowledge of planetology his father had given him, but the young man also understood Freeman society. Leet was the best of both worlds. Pardit only wished the two of them got along better. Taking broad strides, Amon led the way up the rugged slope. Kynes had never been able to see the actual trail in the rocks, but tried to place his boots in the same crannies, on the same flat stones, as his lieutenant did. "Quickly, Amakynes." Amon reached down with his hand. "We must not tarry here in the open." The day was hot, the sun blistering the cliffside, and he remembered running for shelter from a Harkonnen patrol with Freeth long ago. How many years had it been? Kynes stepped up onto a broad ledge and then around an elbow of brown rock until he saw the camouflaged entrance seal that prevented moisture loss from the cave. They stepped through. Kynes, Amun, and the 15 Freemen stood inside, stomping their Temag boots and shaking off wind-blown dust from their days of travel across the desert. Automatically, Kynes yanked the nose plugs from his nostrils. The other Freemen did the same, inhaling extravagant breaths of the moisture and plants. He let his eyes fall half-closed, smelling the ambrosia of blooming flowers and fruits and fertilizers, of thick green leaves and dispersed pollens. Four of the Freeman helpers had never been there before, and they rushed forward like pilgrims reaching a long-sought shrine. Amon looked around, sniffing deeply, proud to have been part of this sacred project from the beginning. He tended Kynes like an old mother, making certain the planetologist had everything he needed. "These workers will replace the team already here," Amon said. "We have smaller shifts now because this place has survived, as you said it would. Plaster Basin is an ecosystem of its own. Now we are required to do less work to keep it healthy." Kynes smiled proudly. "As it should be. One day all of Dune will be like this, self-sustaining and self-renewing." He laughed, a short burst of sound. "Then what will you Freemen do to keep yourselves busy?" Amon's nostrils flared, calloused from perpetually wearing nose plugs. "This is not yet our world, Amakynes. Not until we rid it of the hated Harkonnens." Kynes blinked and nodded. He'd given little thought to the political aspect of the process. He had seen this only as an ecological problem, not a human one. Yet another thing he had missed. His son was right. The great Pardit Kynes had tunnel vision, seeing far into the future along a certain path, but missing all the hazards and distractions along the way. He had done the important ecological work, though. He had been the prime mover, starting what he hoped would be a planet-wide avalanche of change. "I'd like to see this entire world caught up in a net of plants," he said. Amun made a wordless sound of agreement. Anything the Prophet Kynes said was important and worth remembering. They strolled deeper into the moist cavern to view the gardens. The Freemen knew their duties, and they would continue the plantings, even if it took centuries. Through the geriatric qualities of their melange-filled diet, some of the younger ones might actually see the grand plan come to fruition. Kynes was satisfied just to observe the indications of change. The Plaster Basin project was a metaphor for all of Dune. His plan was now so firmly established in the Freeman psyche that it would continue even without his guidance. These hardy people had been infected by the dream, and the dream would not die. From now on, Kynes would be little more than a figurehead, the prophet of ecological transformation. He smiled softly to himself. Perhaps now he could make time to see the people around him, get to know his wife of 20 years, and spend more time guiding his son. Deep inside the cave, he examined dwarf trees laden with lemons, limes, and the sweet round oranges known as portugals. Amun walked beside him, looking over the irrigation systems, the fertilizers, the progress of the plantings. Kynes remembered showing Freeth the portugals when he'd first brought her here, and the look of pleasure on her face when she tasted the honey-sweet orange flesh. It had been one of the most marvelous experiences in her entire life. Now Kynes stared at the fruit and knew he would have to take some of them back for her. "When was the last time I brought her a gift?" He couldn't remember. Amun went over to the limestone walls, touching them with his fingers. The chalky rock was soft and wet, unaccustomed to so much dampness. With his keen eyes, he followed disturbing traceries along the wall and ceiling, fracture lines that should not have been there. "Amma Kynes," he said, "these cracks concern me. The integrity of this cave is suspect, I believe." As the two of them watched, one of the cracks grew visibly, jagging left and then right in a fine black lightning bolt. "You're right. The water is probably making the rock expand and settle over how many years now?" The planetologist raised his eyebrows. Amun calculated. 20, Amma Kynes. With a popping, shattering sound, a crack spread across the ceiling, and then others in a chain reaction. The Freeman workers looked up in fear, then glanced over at Kynes, as if the great man could somehow avert disaster. "I believe we should get everyone out of the cave. Now!" Amun took the planetologist's arm. "We must evacuate until we are sure this is safe." Another loud boom sounded deep within the mountain, a grinding of rock as broken slabs shifted and tried to find a new stable point. Amun tugged at the planetologist, while the other Freeman scurried toward the exit. But Kynes hesitated, pulling his arm free of his lieutenant's grasp. He had promised himself to give Freeth some of the ripe portugals, to show her that he did indeed love and appreciate her, despite his inattentiveness for many years. He hurried to the small tree and plucked some of the orange fruit. Amun rushed back to take him away. Kynes cradled the portugals against his chest, very glad that he had remembered to do this one important thing. Stilgar brought the news to Leet Kynes. In her siege quarters, Ferula was sitting at a table with her young son, Leet Chi, cataloging the jars of herbs she had gathered over the years, sealing the pots with resin and verifying the potency of the substances. On a bench near his new wife and adopted child, Leet Kynes read through a purloined document that detailed the location of Harkonnen spice and military stockpiles. Stilgar held back the privacy curtain, waited like a statue. He stared at the far wall, not blinking his deep blue eyes. Immediately, Leet sensed something was wrong. He had fought beside this man, raided Harkonnen supplies, killed enemies. When the Freeman commando did not speak, Leet stood. "What is it, Still? What's happened?" "Terrible news," the man finally answered, his words like cold lead dropping heavily onto the ground. "Your father, Amma Kynes, has been killed in a cave-in at Plaster Basin. He and Amun and most of the work crew were trapped when the ceiling collapsed. The mountain fell on them." Ferula gasped. Leet found that all words had been stolen from him. "But that can't be," he finally said. "He had more work left to do. He had..." She dropped one of her small jars. It shattered, spilling powdered green leaves in a pungent splash pattern across the worn floor. "Amma Kynes has died among the plants that were his dream," she said. "A fitting end," Stilgar said. For some time, Leet was speechless. Thoughts whirled in his head, memories and wishes, as he listened to his wife and Stilgar, and knew that the labors of parted Kynes must continue. The Amma had trained his disciples well. Leetkynes himself would proceed with the vision. From what Farula had just said, he could already see how the story of the prophet's tragic death, his martyrdom, would be passed from freeman to freeman. And it would grow with each retelling. A fitting end, indeed. He remembered something his father had told him. The symbolism of a belief can survive far longer than the belief itself. Stilgar said, "We could not collect the water of the dead for our tribe. Too much dirt and rock covered the bodies. We must leave them in their tomb." "As it should be," Farula said. "Plaster Basin shall be a shrine. Amakynes died with his lieutenant and his followers, giving his body's water to the planet he loved." Stilgar narrowed his eyes and looked down his chiseled nose at Leet. "We will not let the Yama's vision die with him. You must continue his work, Leet. The freemen will listen to the Yama's son. They will follow your commands." In a daze, Leetkynes nodded, wondering if his mother had already been told the news. Trying to be brave, he straightened his shoulders as the deeper implications penetrated his mind. Not only would he continue to be the emissary for the freemen in the terraforming project, now he had an even greater, more far-reaching responsibility. His father had filed the appropriate documents long ago, and Shaddam IV had approved them without comment. "I am the Imperial Planetologist now," he announced. "By my vow, the transformation of Dune will continue." The man faced with a life-and-death decision must commit himself, or he will remain caught in the pendulum. From In My Father's House, by the Princess Irulan. The statue of Leto's paternal great-grandfather, Duke Miklos Atreides, stood tall in the courtyard of the Kala City Hospital, stained by time and moss and guano. As Leto passed the serene visage of an ancestor he had never known, he nodded in habitual respect, then hurried up a set of wide marble-crete stairs. Though he limped slightly, Leto was substantially recovered from his physical injuries. Once again he was able to face each day without the smothering blackness of despair. By the time he reached the uppermost floor of the medical building, he was hardly winded at all. Rumber was awake. The Duke's personal physician, who had continued to treat Rumber until the impending arrival of the cyborg team, greeted him. "We have begun to communicate with the Prince, my Lord Duke." White-coated medical attendants stood around the life support pod and its elaborate tubes, injection bags, and blood purification pumps. Machinery hummed and whirred, as it had for months. But it was different now. Stopping Leto before he could rush forward, the doctor said, "There was, as you know, severe trauma to the right side of the Prince's head. But the human brain is a remarkable instrument. Already Romber's cerebellum has shifted control functions to new regions. Information is flowing through the neural pathways. I believe this will make the work of the cyborg team considerably easier." Tasha leaned over the coffin-shaped pod, stared inside. "I love you, Romber. You never needed to worry about that." In response, synthesized humming words droned from a speaker box. "I love you, too, and always will." The words were distinct and precise, unmistakable but with a pause between each, as if Romber still hadn't accustomed himself to the speech process. The Duke stared, transfixed. "How could I have even considered giving you over to the Tleilaxu?" The sleek pod lay open, revealing Romber's scarred lump of skin and bone, bristling with tubes, wires, and connections. The doctor said, "At first we could only speak to him by using an Ixion code, pulses and taps, but now we've managed to link the voice synthesizer up to his speech center." The prince's remaining eye was open, showing life and awareness. For long moments, Leto stared into Romber's nearly unrecognizable face, and he could think of nothing to say.
What is he thinking? How long has he known what happened to him?
Synthesized words poured out of the speaker beside the pod.
Leto, friend, how are coral gem beds this year? Have you been diving lately?
Almost giddy with relief, Leto chuckled.
Better than ever, Prince. We'll go out again together. Soon.
Suddenly a wash of tears stung his eyes.
I'm sorry, Romber. You don't deserve anything but the truth.
The lump of Romber's body didn't move, and Leto saw only a few spasmodic muscle twitches beneath his skin. The artificial voice from the speaker conveyed no emotions, no inflections.
When I am a cyborg, we can build a special suit. We'll go diving again. Wait and see.
Somehow the exiled prince had accepted the dramatic changes to his body, even the prospect of cyborg replacements. His good heart and infectious optimism had helped Leto through the darkest times after the old duke's death. Now Leto would be there for Romber.
Remarkable, the doctor said.
Romber's eye did not waver from Leto.
I want a Harkonnen beer.
Leto laughed. On his left, Tesha clutched his arm. The hideously injured prince would still go through oceans of pain, both physical and mental. Romber seemed to sense Leto's gloom, and his speech improved a little.
Don't be sad for me. Be happy. I look forward to my cyborg parts.
Leto leaned closer.
I am Ixion. No stranger to machines.
It all seemed so unreal to Leto, so impossible. And yet it was happening. Over the centuries, cyborg attempts had always failed when the body rejected its synthetic parts. Psychologists claimed the human mind refused to accept such a drastic intrusion by mechanicals. The deep-seated fear dated back to the machine-induced horrors of pre-Butlerian days. Supposedly, this Souk Dr. Yue, with his intensive research program on Rachis, had solved such problems. Only time would tell. But even if the components worked as promised, Romber would function little better than the stiff old Ixion mechs. The adjustment would not be easy, and delicate control would never be possible. In the face of his injuries and disabilities, would Tesha abandon him and return to the sisterhood? In his youth, Leto had listened with rapt attention as Paulus and his veteran soldiers told of severely injured men performing incredible feats of bravery. The triumph of the human spirit over insurmountable odds. Leto had never seen anything like that firsthand. Romber Vernius was the bravest man Leto had ever met. 2 weeks later, Dr. Wellington Yue arrived from Ritchie's, accompanied by his cyborg development team of 24 men and women, and 2 shuttle loads of medical equipment and supplies.